Welcome to the Cauldron Series with Dr. Barry Goff, a deep dive into the turbulent and transformative decades of British Columbia's past. In this episode, we turn our attention to communications, the lifelines of a growing province in the late 19th and early 20th century. As British Columbia emerged from isolation and pushed towards modernity, the arrival of telegraphs, postal routes, and eventually wireless signals reshaped how people connected across vast, rugged landscapes. Dr. Goff explores how these evolving networks influence politics, commerce, and community, and how the struggle to communicate mirrored the struggle to define British Columbia's place in a changing Canada. Without further ado, Dr. Barry Goff and communications during the Cauldron.
In the modern period, that is to say, after James Cook arrives in 1778, I think the modern period for West Coast Canadian and American history begins with Cook, although a claim could be made for the Russians before that. But for the British Columbia instance, Cook at Nootka in 1778 is really important. When he arrived, he was on a surveying situation trying to determine a Northwest Passage. This ties in with communications theory, too, because they were looking for a faster route to get from the United Kingdom and from Europe, even from the eastern United States, to the ports of China, Korea, and Canton. And almost immediately, people like John Mears set out from places like Madras in India, and James Charles Stewart Strange does similarly. And then we have the Londoners coming into it, and the Bostonians. All of them are coming by ship. The major revolution in communications is provided by the square-rigged ship. And this means that 18,000 miles could be under the keel from the time you left, say, Southampton to the time you got to Nootka Sound. So the communications were breaking down the barriers of the Cordillera of North America. BC, then as now, faces the Pacific. It depends upon mainly commerce on the Pacific. It's not that the overland traffic does not matter, but if you look at our ports and you look at our shipping and you look at our trading partnerships, they are connected by the communications of the Pacific. And while I'm on it, of course, the introduction of the container ship has also revolutionized that. Now, it's outside of the period of the Cauldron, but it absolutely fits the paradigm that I'm talking about. Now, even as late as 1910, when my family came to Victoria, there were two ways of getting here. My family, is in terms of persons and personal luggage, went from Liverpool to Quebec City, Montreal, then on the CPR to Vancouver, then by CPR ship to Victoria. That was one long link by one corporate arrangement. CPR had mastered this. So was the precursors of the Canadian National Railway system. So the Laurentic, which was the ship that my parents, grandparents came on, was the great liner. And it's the fast means. When the turbine comes to shipping, then it speeds it up altogether in addition. The other way that my parents and family's possessions came to Victoria was by Cape Horn. My family's old piano came by way of Cape Horn. So did the steamer trunks, because freight was easier and cheaper that way. And they would have to coordinate the arrival and departure of this, but sooner or later, everything would be reunited. Now, this brings up the next question about the fight that went on between those proponents of coming to North America, West Coast, by way of the Panama route or by Cape Horn. And we've find that a distinguished student of maritime history, John Haskell Kemble, who wrote a book, wrote about the gold rush by way of Panama, He has these details to tell us. In 1851, the quickest way to get from New York to San Francisco was by sailing a full-rigged clipper ship round Cape Horn. In fact, the fastest way was the Panama route, catching a steamship to Aspinwall, crossing the Isthmus of Panama, and then boarding another steamer to San Francisco. Assuming close connections and no mishaps, by no means assured, the trip could be made in something like 30 days. For anyone interested in this fascinating area, look at Kemble's The Panama Route. Now, the editor of the Sea History magazine, which I'm awfully keen about, adds this, that Kemble wrote, the Cape Horn route took more time, but it was less complicated, and that the emigrants stayed in the same ship all the way. Although the part of the course lay through notoriously rough seas, events proved that the traveler who chose this route was surest of reaching California alive and in good health. Of the passengers arriving in 1849 at San Francisco, 15,000 plus had come round Cape Horn as compared to 6,000 plus by way of Panama. The latter route gained quickly in popularity. However, as its advantages of speed became known, ignorance concerning it was dispelled. Thus, in 1850, there were 11,000 arrivals by way of the Horn and 13,000 by way of Panama. In 1852, more than 20,000 traveled to San Francisco by the way of Panama, and the number continued to be usually between 15,000 and 20,000 a year until the completion of the Transcontinental Railroad in the year 1869. At the same time, the Cape Horn route declined in popularity as a passenger carrier, although it continued to be of great importance for the transportation of cargo to and from California. In short, then, the system of linkages was becoming more constrained or contracted by the great route across the Panama. It had been a horror in the days of Governor Blanchard's passage, but increasingly, as the railways were built and the swamps were drained and eventually how the mosquito was dealt with, a Panama Canal was finally built. And as I said on another occasion, the Panama Canal was the great proponent or pushing forward of the trade of the Port of Vancouver. Now, shortly thereafter, telegraph came into existence, and this is a coded message system. You pay by the minute, and everything is in code, and everything is decoded at the end of the day. Morse code comes in consequence of this, and plain language as well. In this wonderful book, I hope you've read it or can get a copy of it, Notes from the Century Before, a journal from British Columbia by Edward Hoagland, he writes about Telegraph Creek. Telegraph Creek came into being when the Collins Overland Telegraph Company conceived of running a telegraph line from New York to London the long way round the world by way of Alaska and Russia. It was a grandiose plan. At the end of 2 years, in 1867, they had managed to cut a thin rail through the wilderness from the existing transmission lines in southern British Columbia as far north as Stikine. At the same time, however, a rival group had been racing them, laying a cable under the ocean, which was the short route. When this unlikely idea suddenly succeeded, the line which had been intended to cross the continents was abandoned just as it stood, with hasty loops drooping from the poles and reserve coils of wire in the crew cabins. The village on the river at the terminus did survive, since the area had had gold rush shortly before. Another minor rush occurred in the year 1873 to Dease Lake, 70-odd miles further inland. Also, it was fine fur country, and the Tatlin Indians had their capital village close by at the mouth of the main salmon tributary. Between the whites and Indians, the population of the region of 80,000 square miles, as big as two Ohios, was estimated at 2,000 people by a broad board of citizens in Wrangell, Alaska, which is a settlement lying in the Alaska Panhandle at the mouth of the Stikine, Right now, the population might be half of this. He's writing in 1969. One more small quote to add to this description. The mammoth Klondike strike way to the north stirred the Stikine into a frothy of anxiety activity in the year 1898. The river was considered to be one of the possible corridors. After reaching Telegraph Creek by boat or on the river ice, a prospector could get to the headwaters of a tributary of the Yukon River by hiking across a couple of 100 miles of tough bush. There, theoretically, to piece together a raft and drift at his ease for the rest of the trip. Scarcely anybody did drift. In fact, rather few reached Yukon territory at all by this route, but money and stampeders poured into town. The government even revived the Collins Overland Line, pushing it hurriedly north to the gold town of Atlin on the provincial border, and thence to Whitehorse and Dawson, the hub, which had had no direct communication with the rest of the world before. It became called Telegraph Creek, Telegraph Trail, especially the stretch of 210 miles from Telegraph Creek to Atlin, and the southerly part which passed 400 miles through unremitting mountains from Telegraph Creek down to Hazleton. Men who couldn't afford the boat fares, or who wanted to stay on Canadian soil all the way, or those deluded by looking at a map, or perhaps not looking at a map, attempted to walk it. The trail was soon strewn with dead pack horses and cast off equipment, the game scared away, the trees scrawled with messages. The people who limped into Telegraph Creek generally beat a retreat to the coast and out. So there's a great description of what was happening in the interior with the possibility of developing and using a telegraph. But the undersea telegraph had been completed across the Atlantic, and messages started flowing there in the mid-1860s. An important feature arrangement was the expertise that the Royal Navy had provided. So in global thinking and even in military strategy, this globalone talk, this the world encompassed by communications. So to conclude, I'm Barry Goff. I'm the creator of the Cauldron series. I'm supported by wonderful persons, including my quarterback, Greg Scott, to whom I give praise. And we hope you'll look at other episodes of the Cauldron series and see the vitality and the variety of stories that comes out of the Vancouver Island and British Columbia experiences of this amazing epoch of our history. And there's more to come. Thank you for your attention, and stay tuned. Bye-bye.